right, welcome to the 3 o'clock docket. Apologize for starting late, but we had lots of questions before you, and we probably will have lots of questions for you. So, but I understand both sides are ready.
State's ready, Your Honor.
All right, then if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
The court will now call Thomas Milligan versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Westfall will argue for the attorney. Will argue for the state.
Okay, Wes.
May it please the court, Mr. Mallon. Actually, Judge, in light of the court's comments about all the questions you were going to ask us, I was hoping you'd be more like Clarence Thomas and only occasionally utter a sound. No, actually, let me. Mr. Olivas appeals his conviction for capital murder. The death penalty was waived. He was sentenced to confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for life without parole. We raised 3 points of error. The first one is the sufficiency of the evidence point. And I'm going to kick that to the end, if I may. I think that issue was actually quite thoroughly briefed by both parties. I'll address it briefly, but I want to get to the second point of error, if I could, and that's the seizure or acquisition of what is termed CSLI. I think I got it right. I get the letters mixed up. Cell site location information. As I sit here and talk to the court, if someone were to call my cell phone, which is in my pocket, without any action on my part, AT&T would be able to identify my location within a range of area. And that's the issue that Mr. Olivas complained about at trial, filed a motion, I think a First Amendment motion, to suppress the evidence, and evidentiary hearing was held.
What range around that cell tower? I believe
his, the testimony at trial was they, the AT&T people could not place them at the specific apartment or location of the homicide, of the murder. His cell was bouncing off a tower, which was about 0.4 miles, if I recall the record, from the location of the murder. Now, he had offered an explanation about being at a bar playing a video game that was in that same general area. But the evidence at trial didn't establish his specific location at the apartment, but it was in close. It was probably the nearest tower to the murder location.
Does the record reflect the maximum distance away from that tower he could have been and still?
I apologize to the court. I don't recall the technical details of that. I mean, I think we all know that these towers have a distance of which dissipates, I suppose, over a span of distance, and then you get to another tower and another tower, and they just simply, we change towers as we converse on our phones or text or search the internet. So I apologize. I don't recall the specifics.
But your issue is the privacy right.
Well, by virtue of owning one of these, which I think is almost universal, maybe it's not as critical and necessary as food and water and air, but it's become almost that much. Our location, our comings and goings are constantly being transmitted to the cell towers or AT&T or whoever our service provider is. And this is what has raised a significant question, because the courts have traditionally relied on what we call the third-party doctrine. You know, if I do business with a bank and I write a check or I deposit money or I withdraw money and to whom I write my checks, I'm engaged in an action of voluntarily transmitting information to a bank. Cell phones, not necessarily the case. The circuit courts have split. Most of them have gone with a 30-party doctrine. This is an issue that's pretty ripe and prime for a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, quite frankly. There were a couple of federal district court cases addressing this issue that came out and said that this was a search that did require a search warrant. Of course, the criteria is whether there's an expectation of privacy.
How far was the bar that he went to,
Your Honor,
from the apartment?
They were in fairly close proximity, but I don't recall the specific distance.
0.4 miles.
Sorry.
Excuse me. 0.4 miles.
Well, my understanding of the 0.4 miles, unless I misread the record, was that's the distance of the tower that Mr. Olivas' phone was talking to and the place where the fire and the homicide and the murders occurred, which is why they could not say Mr. Olivas was at that location committing that offense.
Does your record show that the type of area the apartment was in?
I think there were apartments and there were businesses in close proximity. I don't recall the record references. Perhaps Mr. Mallon can help us.
Well, when the description was made of the location, are we talking about a high-density apartment area?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I believe this was a high-density area, as I recall.
And does your record show whether the appellant knew or did not know where the decedent lived?
That was an issue in controversy. According to statements by the deceased that were part of the evidence in the case, Mr. Olivas was not aware of her location and address, and that he had told the police that he had called her to seek that information. I don't recall if it was a text or what the information was, but the deceased, there was some information in the record that acknowledged that the defendant did not know, or the appellant did not know, the location, precise address location. Actually, that I don't think it was really in conflict. I think the clear state of the record was Mr. Olivas did not know the address location of the deceased.
Wasn't there something in the record about his calling her more than once to get directions to the apartment?
That is correct. There were efforts to call. And of course, a lot of cell phone information, as is typical in these cases, was presented. And so one was, you know, the court obviously and the jury obviously was examining the consistency and if there was a claim of a call, is there a record showing a call and things of that nature.
And stop there a second.
Yes, sir.
Second point is that they shouldn't have gotten the cell phone information. I believe that Chuck's position is that that's kind of harmless, not that big a deal. My question is, if this is a high-density apartment area, and you've told me that all the evidence shows your client did not know where the decedent lived.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
There's no evidence in this record to show he knew.
I believe that's the state of the
then
record.
Then I'm sitting here wondering why you would complain of 50 cell phone calls if your client was in the same general area at a bar, whether it was a mile away or a half a mile away. The guy could have driven and killed her if that had been his choice based on his statement about where he was. And the cell phone records end up to be helpful to you because they buttress the fact that he didn't know where she was, so how could he have killed her?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that because there was no person that said I saw him come and go or placed him at the apartment where the murders occurred.
Address what I just said. I know about all that.
Okay. Well, it puts him in the area where the murder occurred. It does put him in the general proximity.
His own statement did that.
That's true.
And he was on his way to see her.
Well, he was seeking to see her and was trying to inquire, where do I go? And he went to the general area and
calls
stopped
50
at a bar.
Times if you know where you're going. I mean, come on.
There were 50 calls. There were 50 calls reflected in the cell phone records.
I don't recall that. I thought there were a handful of
phone calls. One
of
the briefs said 50. I don't care if there was 10 or 20 or 50. I don't care. The point is there were a lot of calls. And from your point of view, if she doesn't know where she's going, or excuse me, he doesn't know where he's going,
right,
there's plenty of reason to think he's calling her to try and get her to tell him where she lives. And there's no evidence he ever found that out, which is one of your major points, I would think.
Yes, sir.
So it all helps you.
To some extent.
Tell me how it hurts you.
Well, it obviously the state argued at trial that Mr. Levis was the person that killed the two deceased, that the cell phone information supported their point of view, placing him in that area. And
Well, you're not contesting that. You never contested he was there.
Well, after the court overruled and denied the motion to suppress evidence that was lodged by appellant, that is true at trial.
So?
But don't the multiple phone calls show that he was trying to locate her? I mean, doesn't that buttress
your
position?
That was their position at trial. That is correct, Your Honor. That how could he be there killing her?
You argue this case, or did you just appeal?
No, I'm the appellate. That was Tim Moore and Joetta Keene.
Well, did the record show that the lawyer's trying to say 50 calls shows he didn't know where she was?
That was argued at trial, yes, sir.
Okay. By the way, you may not want to do it, but I'm concerned about the first point.
Okay. Well, I'll
time window. See if you can answer just a few questions.
Yes, sir.
What is the time window of opportunity, if you will, that would permit the defendant killing the woman?
If the court's...
It was reported at 10, 11, I think, or somewhere around there.
That sounds correct. That sounds
correct.
Okay,
from the defense point of view, he says he left the area at 9:30 to go home.
Yes, sir.
Because he didn't know where she was and so on.
Yes, sir.
And I believe somebody's out there grilling something and sees some hooded fellow walking from the apartment?
Yes, sir. There was a hooded, they couldn't even say fellow, a
All
human.
I'm interested in is the time.
Yes, sir.
Do you remember
I think the time sequences did not coincide.
Well, the guy got home after 9 o'clock.
Yes, sir.
Did his cooking maybe at 9:15.
Yes, sir. And there was an argument about the time that the homicides had to occur wouldn't coincide with the location of Mr. Olivas.
And was the time of death? Was this a deal where she is knifed to death and the gas is the cover-up?
The cause of her death, as ruled by the medical examiner, was stabbing. She was stabbed to death, and then the residence was set on fire using an accelerant. There was a small child, the other victim.
I understand that. Well, was the gas used as a cover-up? Is that what the argument was?
I think that was part of the argument, and then there was it was not entirely clear, according to the testimony of the medical examiner, what the cause of death of the child was. It could have been by fire, but there wasn't material in the lungs and so forth that would indicate that.
Okay,
so a cover-up is the most likely explanation.
Does your record show anything about any threat made by the appellant towards her or the child?
I think there are statements to third parties concerning his motive and displeasure at being identified
as a child.
I
understand the question.
But I don't recall a threat made directly to the victim.
Threat on the lives were not in this record.
Not that I recall.
I mean, I didn't read it in the briefs.
Sure. I don't recall a threat being made from the defendant or appellant
okay.
to the victim.
There's a smell of gas in the car. That's generally what I got out of the briefs. But I also heard something about a state witness saying you can't tell gas by the smell.
That is correct. There was
now, other than that, was there any evidence that gas was in the car?
He had made admissions to the car owner apologizing for the smell of gas. He had had a lawnmower.
And then he changed his mind and said it wasn't a lawnmower?
Yes, sir. Well, there were a number of statements that he made that conflicted with one another, including statements made to the police that were demonstrably false regarding various events, which is the suspicious raising act. Matter as far as the sufficiency of the evidence is concerned.
Was there any explanation for the scratches?
He gave an explanation that he suffered
to
law enforcement who noticed the scratches and photographed the scratches
on the arm.
That he suffered from eczema. He had quite a number of lateral scratches. There were a number of people who knew him.
On the arm?
I believe it was on his arm and back.
Okay.
And
the state tried to disprove that. All I'm asking you is there were scratches on the arm, possibly the back.
Yes, sir.
Which leads you as the lawyer to say, on the other side, was there forensic evidence that part of the skin was under her fingernails.
That is correct, and there was no, I believe there was evidence there was no such material under her fingernails.
Okay.
So
was there any evidence as to when the scratches were inflicted?
He made a claim of eczema, but there was no other evidence concerning the temporal time frame that the scratches had occurred.
On the body of the lady, the deceased.
Yes, sir.
Were three hairs, I understand.
Absolutely, and they did not match appellant. They did not match the deceased. They would have identified to an unknown third party.
Male, female?
I don't recall the gender being specified.
Was there any kind of attack on the lady before her death? Was there a sexual attack in this case?
I think there was no evidence of that, Your Honor.
What relevance does the silencer have here?
Well, Judge, that's my point three, and it has no relevance.
Maybe to show he's scoping around here for a weapon to kill somebody, is that the idea?
Well, he's seeking a weapon and a silencer, which there's no evidence he ever even acquired. He asked questions about how to acquire one, and a guy who's an expert in guns said, well, that's a heavily regulated matter. It's possible to get them legally, but it's very difficult. And so the state offers that in a case where the people died from stabbing and or fire. The interesting thing is the state argued at trial and does on appeal apparently that this was extraneous evidence offered to show intent. There was never any question about intent. If someone is stabbed and then set on fire using an accelerant, I don't think there can be a great debate about what the intent was. There was no issue on intent. The issue was identity, and there is no similarity. All these identity cases that we look at say, well, there must be some kind of signature or some similarity. Well, you go from gun not acquired with a silencer or suppressor to a stabbing fire. Where is the similarity in that?
Most of those cases involve where there's two or more murders, comparing the manner in which they were committed.
Yes, or two or more robberies or kidnappings or, you know, something. His explanation to the witness that testified over objection about the silencer and gun was that he sought one to shoot or kill varmints or raccoons or something of that sort. There was never any reference to I need one to kill a person. Was
nobody but an idiot is going to say that anyway.
Certainly.
I want a silencer so I can go shoot somebody.
Certainly.
Was the car tested for gasoline, for the presence of gasoline inside?
It was, and the results came back forensically negative, which is why the state's expert testified that you cannot rely on smell to identify gasoline. And it's actually not gasoline you smell when you think you smell gasoline. It's a component of it. If you look at the sufficiency, I'll go ahead and jump to the sufficiency of the evidence cases. All of those cases, and I noted that the state cited a couple of cases, Torres and Garcia, there's an additional component in...
Is there any one case in your brief that's circumstantial evidence, murder case, that was reversed? If there is not, I might encourage you. I found out that in Dallas, an interesting phenomena happens, as it does in Fort Worth. It is amazing the quality of the lawyers who work for this court. And I mean this, the lawyers on this court are phenomenal, and my two colleagues are very close friends of mine, and I feel the same about them. The problem becomes, and sometimes it's an irritant, that when you have a position to take and the court finds the cases, not the lawyers.
Yes.
So I'm going to encourage both sides to look harder for circumstantial evidence cases involving murders that are either affirmed or reversed that are a little bit more in point here. Otherwise, what you're saying is, hey, I'll give you some general cases.
Yes, sir.
And I'll rely on your judgment to follow the general rules. And I learned a long time ago I never wanted to do that.
Well, you know,
I think
a lot of it has to do with case selection, when the prosecution selects a case
Talking about this case.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, they selected this case for prosecution. It doesn't have any of the earmarkings of all the cases that I've seen where say, okay, it's circumstantial, but it's sufficient. Because in every one of those cases that I found, there's a DNA or there's a blood.
What I'm asking you to do is to kind of give a search again and see if you find any that are reversed.
Yes, sir. Okay. Is my time expired? I believe it is. Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I don't mean
about the reason that the car was searched for evidence of blood. Was there some reason for that, that she might have been carried from somewhere else to his car and then transferred to her apartment after she was dead?
I don't think there was anything in the state's theory that she had been moved, that she was actually killed in the apartment. I think this, it was blood splatter and so forth. The search of the automobile, of course, was to find whether there was actually gasoline, which turned out to be forensically negative, or to find is there any, if Mr. Olivas is actually the actor, the killer, he could have acquired evidentiary genetic material or other evidentiary matter from the crime scene and gotten in the automobile, and it could have been transferred in the automobile, such as the victim's blood or the victim, any other DNA or the victim's hair or something. Of course, there was none. And so that's the absence of evidence in this case is, and it's not that there, in cases where there's no physical evidence of conviction is not obtainable, but there has to be something other than what I submit are false statements by the defendant that certainly raise a suspicion, but I don't think meets the Jackson versus Virginia requirement for sufficiency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh.
Chuck, before I forgot to introduce your panel, the 3 o'clock docket was not here when I introduced them, but to my right is Justice Ann Gardner, to my left, Justice Carrie Fitzgerald, and I'm Leanne Dauphineau. So I apologize for forgetting to introduce the panel. We were just so anxious to get to your argument.
May it please the court, Chuck Mallon for the state, counsel. Let me answer your question concerning cases specifically dealing with circumstantial evidence of murder. There are two cases, and he cites them in both as a brief. Temple versus State and Stobaugh versus State. Temple's from the Court of Criminal Appeals. Stobaugh case is from this court. And I think they're the two significant cases in the Texas jurisprudence was deal with specifically cases which rely solely on circumstantial evidence to establish the offense of murder. Stovall deals with the fact that motive and opportunity cannot be used alone is not sufficient to establish the identity of the perpetrator of the offense, unless the state also establishes that there has been some type of wrongful conduct. I mean, that the death was, or that there's a death, that there's a homicide. And then in order to, and then motive and opportunity can be linked, can link the defendant to the homicide. In Stovall, there was no body. And there was no evidence of any type of wrongful conduct. The victim had just disappeared. Contrary to the Temple case, where there was a body, and the victim died of shotgun wounds, so they were able to link the defendant to the homicide by all the other circumstantial evidence. Stovall does not apply to this case because we have a body, we have a medical examiner who testified that the result of the victim's deaths, there are two victims, the little baby and the mother, was homicide, and the cause of death as to the mother was stabbing by a knife, and the cause of the baby's death was he's burnt to death.
Well, Chuck, okay,
yeah.
In this case, there are three hairs on the mother,
That's correct.
Complainant. But they're not appellants.
No.
And there's nothing of appellant in that apartment or the area directly around the apartment, is there?
There is no physical evidence which connects the defendant to the murder scene, except for the circumstantial evidence.
The circumstantial evidence is he borrowed a car and his phone was in Arlington.
Well, I don't want to make a jury argument for this.
No. But is there anything else?
The evidence established.
Oh, yeah. The bad relationship.
The appellant had a motive. He was angry at the victim because she was seeking child support for the baby. He was angry at the victim because the...
We've seen all the stuff they were angry, but I'm talking about physical evidence or witnesses. Where in the record do we find something that physically ties him to this? I mean, I think it's uncontested that it's murder.
Well, what connects
this murder scene?
What connects him to the scene?
Physical.
His own work. First of all, in order to decide this case, which this court has to look at State's Exhibit 5 and 6. They are the interview of the defendant is a non-custodial interview. He states himself that he was on the way over to the victim's apartment, but he never made it. Then you have to look at the testimony by the FBI. It was FBI agent, Special Agent Sedgwick, who was a member of the CAS team, which is a cellular analysis survey team, which deals with the pings, what towers the phones were. His own cell phone connected him to the scene because the last tower that he was at was 0.4 miles from the apartment where the victim lived. So he was connected to the area.
But I ask Wes this, I'll ask you, is there anything in the record that shows what the radius of the area among from the cell phone was?
Yes, it does, and that's...
What is that?
Yeah. Well, you know, Judge, you have to look at State's Exhibit 297, okay? 297 is the PowerPoint presentation, which Agent... Sedgwick testified as he was leaving. I mean, he tells the officers that between around 3 o'clock, 3:51 in the afternoon, he decides he's going to go over to see the victim because the victim had filed a paternity lawsuit. The attorney general had filed a paternity lawsuit against him at the behest of the victim, the mother of the child, and that she had called him. He said, well, I got, because the attorney general, when they serve a paternity suit, they serve both the father and the father and the mother. And he says, she called him and said, well, I got served with these papers. I don't understand. Why don't you come over and explain it to me?
Had he been served yet?
Pardon me?
Had he been served yet?
He was dodging service from the evidence. I mean, he had not been served, the answer to your court.
Okay.
But he knew the process server had come out to his house to serve the papers and had his address and I think left his card that he had paper. Or he talked to him on the phone.
How far away from the cell tower will the cell tower pick up a phone pinging against that's what I was asking.
I think each cell tower is different.
Right.
I
mean, so this and, cell
I
tower.
I couldn't answer the exact. He details the radius in State's Exhibit 297. You can see, and he testifies to the radius of the last cell tower closest to the victim's house, and it shows the area.
Okay, the cell tower was 0.4 miles. But how far was the telephone?
I can't answer.
So there's no evidence how far the telephone was, only how far the cell tower was. Is that right?
That's correct.
So how far away could the phone have been and still pinged off that cell tower? Is that in the record at all?
It is circumstantial because it shows the exact radius. It shows the exact pie shape of the...
Wait a minute. Does the 0.4 relate to where the apartment is in the phone or the apartment in the tower?
0.4 miles is where the cell tower is from the
apartment
where the murders occurred.
So that's where the cell tower is. He could have been a mile away.
Yes,
I had no idea that was.
It was a quarter mile. Yeah.
So it gets further.
But you can. I mean, it doesn't mean you're a quarter mile away. I mean, he did testify. You could be at the apartment and call.
Chuck, if it's a quarter, if let's say 0.4 means a half a mile.
Yeah.
If you're measuring from the apartment to the cell tower, then her question is. Justice Dauphineau's question is, what's the radius that cell tower covers? Does it cover the apartment?
Yes.
All the way to the apartment?
Yes.
Beyond the apartment?
Yes.
How far beyond?
That I don't know.
Is it?
I mean, I personally don't know.
Is it in the record?
I think it is.
Is it 360 degrees?
No.
Can you tell us what, can you fill us in rather than having us ask you questions?
it does it by...
Because frankly, until Justice Dauphineau asked that, I didn't have a clue about it.
I mean, he... As far as the charts go, he doesn't... You can look at what it is, it's a street map. Of the various areas, from when he left, when he left what they call Volcanoes Bar, in another part of Arlington, Volcanoes is up there, I think, by off of the airport freeway in Arlington, and on his way to where the victim lived, he goes from each cell. When he made a phone call, or made a text, it would show what tower as he progressed. To the area where the victim lived, what tower was the text or what tower the phone call was being made from?
Let me ask you something else, because we're going to go into the record on this anyway. Did you say she called him and asked him to come to the apartment to look over papers that she was served on this child support?
No, I said he said. He told the police officer.
He said she asked him to come over?
Yes.
So we have 10 to 50 phone calls going back and forth?
You have...
He still doesn't know where she lives?
Well, that's what he said, because if you look at State's Exhibit Number 300, which deals with the calls and texts between the victim and the defendant on 3/20/11, the date of the murder, these calls and texts start at 3:51 p.m. on 3/20. And at 10:07 p.m. on 3/20, and there's 50 of them.
What's 10:07?
Yeah, 10:07.
What does that stand for?
That was the last call.
That was the end of the
last
call?
And it was a text. It was a text from the defendant or the appellant. To the victim at 10:07. And
does that mean that the victim was murdered after 10:07?
No. No, it doesn't, because the 911 call was at 10:11. 911 call, the 911 call concerning the fire at the victim's apartment was at 10:07. I believe, or 10:11.
So that's a text, but it's not an indication of whether the text was actually.
If somebody wanted to, if an individual wanted to, for instance, I think the state's theory where he was still texting her as if he didn't know she had been murdered. So he, you know, there was no back. She never retexted him back. I can text you if you don't. I mean, keep on texting you continually.
Does the information you have in this record show the exact times of all the communications between the two phones?
Yes.
Excuse me, I was just going to say, you'd answer your phone if you were being called, but you don't have to answer a text.
That's correct.
It will still show that it came in.
What was the last phone call?
10:07.
No, not text.
You mean actual phone call? That's a good question.
Did you all do a diagram with all?
Army?
Did you do a diagram about all this? What we're asking you?
There's already one.
What's the exhibit?
It's 300. Exhibit 300.
Okay, and it'll show whether the call was answered or went to voicemail, or when it goes to voicemail, does
yes,
that?
Yes, it shows if it goes to voicemail.
Okay.
It does.
As opposed to being answered.
Yeah.
If it's it all on 300.
And it shows with no connection. The last call was at 7:10 p.m. It was from the victim to appellant, and it lasted 1 minute and 48 seconds.
Is it fair to say, Chuck, that the hoodie person left the apartment that she lived in? Is that what your theory is?
Absolutely.
And is it also fair to say that the witness who saw the hoodie didn't know anything about the figure, male, female, identity? So for our purposes, it's a human being walking out of the apartment that could be anybody.
Yeah, and the human being that showed up for the non-custodial interview a few hours later at the Grapevine Police Department was the defendant in a hoodie.
Okay. Chuck, you walked to the podium with shoes on.
Yeah.
So did your opponent.
Yeah.
Suppose somebody saw somebody walking out with shoes on. That isn't a hoodie a pretty common garment?
Yes. And
you have one?
Do I have a hoodie? Absolutely.
I have one.
Yeah, well,
hoodie doesn't tell you a whole lot.
But I'm not showing up for the police department.
You wouldn't prosecute someone for murder based on a hoodie.
Of course not.
So,
but it's still relevant evidence.
You would admit, while that is a circumstance, that certainly doesn't tie down to this guy.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
It doesn't tie him down as the perpetrator. It's the cumulative force of all the other incriminating evidence. I mean, you're talking, if you want to talk about, you remember we talked about the scratches? If we want to talk about the scratches, which she said was eczema, I would have point the court to State's Exhibit 228, 229, and 230. And I'll show this is not eczema. This was a struggle.
What are you showing me?
I'm showing you the scratches on his back.
Okay, when were they inflicted?
Well, the state's theory.
Does the record show, that's the precedent for every question, does the record show those scratches were recent so that you could have told a jury, hey, recent scratches, not some sickness?
Well, I think he testified. I mean, I think he, when he talks to the officers on State's Exhibit Number 6 during the non-custodial interview, he tells the officers that I don't want to show you my body because I've been recently scratching myself, and that I have eczema, and I scratch myself till it starts to bleed, and I don't want to take my shirt off and let you take a photograph. And finally, he consents to the. Signs a consent search to allow the photographing of the scratches. And so out of his own mouth, he says that they're recent.
Okay, so that
But all the other evidence showed, it shows they're not eczema, because they lied about that. It wasn't eczema.
Were there any other significant lies?
Well, I mean, he, as far as the state goes, that he borrowed a man another woman's car, that it was a car that the state believes was the how he got to the it was the car that he was driving that night. He calls her and says, "I'm going to return your car, but I want to let you know it smells of gas." And she tells him, and we took well. Leave the windows down so the gas vapors will dissipate. And they talk about how did it happen. And he says, "Well, I was moving a lawnmower and I spilled the gas in the car."
And he denies the lawnmower to a policeman later.
Pardon me?
He denied that a lawnmower
yes.
was.
Yes, eventually, he denied that he moved the lawnmower to the police.
No.
Can I say one thing?
Say
I just want to say that on the cell phone tower and the third party disclosure, the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I signed my brief, just recently rejected the appellant's claim, said that it's, there's no reasonable expectation in privacy in cell site location data. So the state didn't have to get a warrant. Let me give you
what is that case?
It's Ford versus State. Let me give you the cite on that. /477 Southwest 3rd, 321, December 16th, 2015. And it's the very issue which the appellant is raising in the second point of error.
Okay. All right.
I guess my time's up.
We took all your time.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it?
Okay, Wes.
Briefly clarify a couple of issues and assist the court hopefully in locating items. The last call or phone activity was at 10:07, as Chuck mentioned, within the zone. The zone being from the tower that's 0.4 miles from the murder scene. Interestingly, because I think there could be some confusion here, if you look at the record, the technology is capable of saying, here's a tower, here's the apartment, those are 0.4 miles apart. They're only able, as far as Mr. Olivas or the appellant's location, is to say he's within the tower zone, but we can't say he's 0.4 or 0.8 or 1 mile or a tenth of a mile. They're not able to make that delineation. The technology doesn't do that.
Well, if I punch the button on my phone that says find my phone, it can tell me exactly where it is.
I've used that feature as well, and I don't think it's as precise as saying you're at this apartment or you're 0.4 miles away. At least I get a little map, which I look and I go, yeah, that's kind of where I am, but I may not be where that specific dot is. At least that's my understanding from the court record. Regarding the timing, the individual, his name was Paul Lopez, who testified that he saw the hoodie figure that he couldn't identify by gender, race, otherwise, not even identifying a color of hoodie to say, well, it was a blue hoodie, and then appellant, when he shows up at the police department, has a blue hoodie. It wasn't even that precise. It's just a person with a hoodie, which is probably perhaps not as generic as shoes, but pretty close these days. He said he saw that individual between 9 and 10 p.m. apparently walking away from the area of the apartment. The clear evidence in the record was that this person could not even specifically be associated with the fire. It was just an individual that was described in the vicinity around the time, shortly before the 911 call was made, which I believe was at 10:11.
So no evidence he was seen coming out of that apartment?
No, Your Honor. It could have been anybody walking through the apartment. But as witnesses would tend to do when something as tragic as this happened is when the police come and they describe everybody they saw. The motive attributed to Mr. Olivas certainly was present, but there's, you know, probably everyone has some reason that they could, someone could identify from a conversation they had that says they're displeased with someone else. The eczema that was referenced, and that was a fairly demonstrated false statement by Mr. Olivas. Now, I will concede at that point. I believe Dr. Pirwani's testimony, because he looked at those photographic exhibits and said these are linear scratches. They're not eczema injuries or it's not the eczema condition that Mr. Leaves described. They were linear scratches. But beyond that, I don't think there was any time frame put on there by Dr. Pirwani other than just looking at the pictures. You can say, well, they're obviously not a month old. And in contrary to that inference is an examination of the fingernails of the deceased, with whom Mr. Olivas is supposed to have this struggle that was speculated on. It's mere speculation, and there's no genetic material under her fingernails that ties to Mr. Olivas, no DNA, that sort of thing. Yet we have these three hairs, these three foreign unexplained hairs, which is really the only physical evidence in the case of some other individual, and they certainly aren't Mr. Olivas. So let's hope the reason for sufficiency of the evidence even being an issue in cases is the worst thing that we can do in the criminal justice system, I believe, is convict a person who's innocent of a crime. There's two harms there. A person who didn't do something gets wrongfully punished, and then the individual that did do it remains at large, and justice has not reached that individual. And so that's why it's so critically important, because there was simply no witness. There was no – it's a series of lies put together and motives, and they say, okay, he did it. The tragic thing is there's a dead baby here. Which reaches out to everyone's heart, and that's a difficult position to be in when you're the person accused. Thank you.
He hadn't been determined to be the father.
I believe there was some DNA testimony offered by the state that it was most likely he was. Quite frankly, on the video interviews of him when he's discussing it, he doesn't seem particularly agitated about that fact. That he might be the father of this child. So, but I think logically from the record, it would appear he's most likely it. You know, he was never served with the lawsuit papers. I think that was an order, perhaps, for him to submit DNA for the child, and so he didn't have the specific knowledge that was attributed to him because it was established there was no service had. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. All right, well, appreciate your argument. Case is submitted. You're free to go about your business.